This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another special podcast on Joy 94.9. Is David Bowie is more Bowie. Can't get enough Bowie.
I was walking down the high street when I heard footsteps behind me, and there was a little old man in scarlet and grey, shuffling away. Well, he trotted back to my house, and he sat beside the telly with his tiny hands on his tummy, chuckling away, laughing all day. Oh, to report you to the gnome office.
Gnome office.
I'm a laughing gnome and you can't catch me. I'm a laughing gnome and you can't catch me, said the laughing gnome.
This is Sonia for Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. David Bowie is, yes, ACMI, Australian Centre for the Moving Image, is doing it. Finally, David Bowie is here. So the many faces of David Bowie, performance and creativity, that is one of the symposium talks that's going to be happening here in Melbourne town for the David Bowie Is, and it's just looking amazing. Now we have one of the panellists here, one of the speakers, Alexandra Haller-Nicholas. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
You got the Bowie excitement?
I am getting a bit Bowie-fied.
Yeah, I can tell because you've got this lightning bolt painted on your face.
Oh, yeah.
You're looking very, very Bowie-bedazzled.
Look, it is pretty extraordinary, actually, after all this time. I would think that surely you've grown out of that, Sonia. No. Do people grow out of Bowie?
Never. You grow into Bowie.
Yeah.
Bowie, every year that he gets older, he reminds us we grow into Bowie.
Mm,
I thought I loved Bowie when I was 20. I had no idea what was to come.
Yeah, so you're part of the symposium. It looks fantastic. Friday the 17th to the 18th. It starts on a Friday, which is a bit unusual, I suppose, for some. And you're one of the first off the block. Look at that.
I am.
The afternoon is yours at 12:40 p.m. So tell us, what is the many faces of David Bowie, performance and creativity?
What is the symposium?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's basically a way of bringing together different kinds of thinking about Bowie. So it straddles academia. It's technically a kind of academic, and I use that very loosely. It's a lowercase academic symposium, but it certainly is bringing together academics and non-academics to have sort of really deep thoughts about David Bowie, to see if we can unpack some of the ideas around this quite complicated pop cultural icon in a kind of formal, structured discussion. So we have panels of three people, I think most of them are, where we all touch on a specific aspect of Bowie and his star persona, and we unpack some ideas around that. And the idea is that we get a bit of a discussion going to try to start to crystallize precisely what it is about David Bowie that makes him so damned magical.
There is something awesome about him. Like, even from the beginning, when you're looking at, I guess, well, the early stages, Space Oddity is just incredible as a song, as what it became historically. And then it sort of disappeared, and then it came back and became its hit. It's just the oddest.
It's a really interesting thing. I mean, everything about Bowie is interesting. So I guess it's sort of a little bit impotent in a way to say this is an interesting thing about Bowie, because it's all relative. It's all fascinating. But Space Oddity is such a fascinating moment in that exploding icon, the exploding myth of David Bowie, in that it's all about performance, even before he was famous, you know, that it's so clearly it's a narrative, you know, he adopts a role and he's performing. Mm. This idea of Bowie being multiple figures and multiple faces and multiple personalities that he brings to life. You're always aware with Bowie that he's performing, whether it's Ziggy Stardust or Major Tom. There's always this fascinating aspect of performance to what he does and to who he is. And I love that that's the name of this exhibition, David Bowie Is, because the answer is not singular. It can't be singular with Bowie. It's never singular. It's always diverse. It's always multiple. And that's, I mean, partially, I think that that's why he's such an important figure from a queer perspective.
Yeah.
Because he refuses a singular identity. He just absolutely, the world that Bowie exists in denies that. It says you can be whatever you want to be and you can be multiple things.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's interesting you bring up the queer element, because it was a Melody Maker, I think, might have been 1970 or 71, where he actually did come out and say, in quotation marks, I'm gay. Mm-hmm. And later on, because of his lifestyle and so on, as we know, he was married for a while to someone he had a child with, of course. I mean, we can't forget Duncan Jones.
Of course.
Just amazing. The strange character, the strange life. I mean, strange isn't odd, but
yeah, no,
just
never
the strangeness of that.
Always, and then, always unstable, but not in a negative way. And that's, I think, one of the things that I really find fascinating about Bowie is that things are never, it's always dynamic. It's always dynamic. Identity is always dynamic, including these sexual identities.
Yeah.
And it's never, I think it would be easy if you were new to, I can't imagine being new to Bowie, but you know, are these just marketing ideas? Is this just a gimmick? But what I'm speaking about at the symposium and what I'm really fascinated with is I'm a film critic with a real interest in genre film. That's my background. I'm an academic / film critic. So I've written books on horror film and exploitation film, cult film. That's my area. Mm. Always with a focus on gender. That's something that even when I try not to focus on it, it's what I'm always interested in.
Back to, yes.
Yeah, and it's always the way that it's very fluid. That you know, things get really interesting when the lines around gender identity start getting a bit hazy and interesting. And Bowie's such a perfect figure for that. And the film that I'm talking about at the symposium, it's a film that was made in 1967, a short 14-minute film that you can find online called The Image. Now, this film wasn't released until 1969 because it was, you know, like a small, low-budget indie film. Mm. So as we all know, if you've had anything to do with small, low-budget indie film, there's sometimes a bit of a delay. Things happen. But these are two really important dates with David Bowie, 1967 and 1969, because 1967, of course, his first album was out. Didn't make that big of a splash. Debut self-titled album. This is the era of The Laughing Gnome. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with the lesser known Bowie classic song, The Laughing Gnome. Very folksy, kind of. It's a kind of very.
It's
an odd little song.
A Benny Hill type of thing.
It's a really weird song.
Eccentric English. Mm-hmm. It does remind me a little bit of maybe if Syd Barrett was doing something else instead of what he was doing.
We all know what he was doing.
Maybe it would be The Laughing Gnome.
Yes.
And of course, thanks for reminding me of that.
We all need to remember. I'm glad that I could go on radio and remind everybody of The Laughing Gnome. And then 1969, of course, is, as you've already said, Space Oddity. So a lot changed in Bowie's life across those 2 years. So 1967, he got paid, I think, £30. He was 20 years old. He got £30 to work for 3 days on this small, short indie film. Called The Image, with a guy called Michael Armstrong, who himself was only about 21. He was a young director. Now, he went on and made an amazing horror film in 1969 called Mark of the Devil, which horror fans amongst you will probably know. Udo Kier, Herbert Lom, really vicious, violent German horror film. But this was Armstrong. Armstrong made this film with Bowie, and Armstrong's one of the first people who could honestly say, I was into early Bowie.
Yeah.
I mean, he's, you know, when people say that, I get a little bit, you know, I kind of roll my eyes. It's like, okay, how early are you going to go back here? You're going back Laughing Gnome, I'm into early Bowie.
Yeah.
Armstrong could say that. He could totally say that.
Yeah.
He saw a copy of the debut album in a record shop and said, that's the guy for my film. The Image is 14 minutes long. It's ostensibly a kind of horror film. It's black and white. It's a silent film. There's no dialogue in it.
Mm.
And it's about a young painter who's painting a portrait of a man, and that man is Bowie, painting it from memory. Mm-hmm. And as he's painting, it's very Oscar Wilde, as he's painting it, the figure that he's painting appears at the window. So his painting comes to life.
Right.
And it's a very, very young Bowie. Pre-fame David Bowie. It's quite an incredible thing to watch. David Bowie before the fame and before the Bowie-ness was connected to him, what we think of as Bowie-ness.
I've seen those films of him miming.
Yes. Yep. The Love You Till Tuesday era stuff. Yeah. Well, he did a lot of training as a mime. He worked with a really famous British mime. He studied under Lindsay Kemp, who's a very famous.
And they studied
under Marcel Marceau. Lindsay Kemp
was
also, he also taught Kate Bush.
Oh, okay. I didn't
together
know that.
Two of my favourites, Bowie and
Bowie and Bush. There you go.
Yeah, so he saw this record cover with David Bowie in it of the debut album, instantly fell in love with Bowie. And yeah, the film follows this painter. The painting comes to life and the painter is trying to kill the painting that has come to life. Yeah, so it goes 14 minutes and every time he kills it, it comes back to life. So Bowie just keeps coming back. It's a kind of art film. It's very simplistic. Bowie's said some pretty unkind things about it, very dismissive. But it's very interesting because it is really, really queer. Like it's not subtle in its sort of sexual politics at all. I mean, there are shots in this that are implicitly sexual. Yeah. It's very, very clear that this is, you know, I mean, much of the criticism about this film has been that it's a kind of gay shame, sort of self kind of guilt thing on the part of the painter that he's sort of suffering, you know, this violent explosion for his kind of gay feelings towards this Bowie figure. So it was very much made with that in mind. Everybody on the set, including the director, were in love with Bowie. There's a beautiful quote from the director where he says, while they were making this, that he knew that Bowie was going to be a star. Mm. And he basically said to Bowie on set that he would either be a giant superstar or he would make a lot of money in the Piccadilly men's toilets. And then
oh, how sweet.
And then 2 years later he became a star. So
Oh, that's cute.
Go there, but the grace of God, we could have had a very different Bowie.
Interesting. it does remind me a little bit of, just jumping way ahead, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. There's that homoerotic kind of relationship and keeps putting pain upon the David Bowie character, still is tortured and beaten but keeps coming back.
There's something not just in Bowie's film appearances, but I think across the board there is this really dynamic, fluid sexual identity at play.
Yeah.
Constantly. No matter what kind of guys he's got, he's playing with these ideas of gender and sexuality being something that can't and shouldn't be locked down.
Even
The Hunger, which is a famous vampire film about bisexuality, with a quite famous scene between Susan Sarandon and Catherine Deneuve.
Yeah, very famous. Is it wine or mayonnaise? I can't. The T-shirt.
Yes,
the T-shirt scene. Everybody knows that one.
But Bowie's in that as well. And, you know, again, it's this film that's really playing in quite a curious way with sexual identity.
Yeah, there's a little androgyny in there too. Mm. I think he has a short liaison with a female in the film, and she's very androgynous.
Yes.
And it's sort
very,
of
very new wave.
Yeah, very new romantics, new wave and everything. And it sort of harks to what comes up in the future. I'm just wondering if Tilda Swinton was watching that film. You know? I am Bowie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's lots of those interesting things. He's kind of like this creature. He is like an alien, but observes us and then reflects back, what's going on.
There's something really uncanny. And I think that Nicholas Rogue, who made The Man Who Fell to Earth in 1976, Rogue made The Man Who Fell to Earth. And we see that alien sexuality become quite literal in Bowie. And I mean, that was Bowie's first really big film. And I don't think it's ever been matched in terms of his screen performance. It's very much a Bowie film. It's a remarkable movie. Very strange. There's a wonderful quote by a woman who writes for Slate called Jessica Winter. And she said that Bowie's always excelled at playing the magic freak, the world-weary, otherworldly outsider who is both adored and contemned for his destabilizing mojo. And I read that and I thought, I wish I wrote that. It's perfect.
Yeah.
This kind of dangerous sexuality that's uncanny, that's both familiar and strange, and it's that tension between attraction and repulsion, I think, with something like The Man Who Fell to Earth, and even in a way with the vampires in The Hunger, that we're repelled and we're attracted at the same time. That push and pull is so intoxicating.
And with The Hunger, it's a double whammy as well, because it's painful. It's almost sadomasochistic. There's this real painful relationship between Catherine's character, Miriam
Blaylock,
and of course David Bowie's character, John. And it's like, do they love each other? Do they hate each other? They don't really, do they? They don't do really anything. It's there to exploit others.
There's so
until
much,
this third wheel turns up, you know.
There's so much going on in that film.
The late Tony Scott.
I think it's his masterpiece. I think it's just his masterpiece.
Would have been interesting to see where his career.
Yeah, well, he got
if
more
he hadn't
kind
been
of,
shadowed by someone else.
Yes, he
perhaps.
Got kind of more action-y near the end. I mean, it was amazing to think that the same person that made some of Tony Scott's later films was the same person that made The Hunger.
Mm.
It's such a unique film. And Bowie himself, when The Hunger came out, he knew that it was something really different. You know, he knew that there's nothing around really that's like this.
Yeah.
But I think that he was quite cluey in that he knew that that would perhaps, that the film would perhaps suffer for that. It didn't go that well critically. It didn't go well that well at the box office
no,
when it came out.
No, it didn't do well at all.
But it's become a massive cult film. I got into that when I was a ghastly teenage goth.
I was about to say, were you a goth? You get excited with the Bauhaus.
Oh, the Bauhaus was the big draw card for me.
What a great scene. I mean, I can watch that scene. It goes for a good 14 minutes.
It's one of the great opening films in horror film
history.
So
there's no dialogue. It's just nightclub eroticism and dark and predatory kind of thing, which is perfect for the 80s.
It's so 80s.
So perfect.
But dark 80s. It's not ironic 80s. There's a really kind of
No, it's not a John Hughes movie.
No, it's not quirky. There's nothing quirky
about
The Hunger.
Breakfast at, what is it called?
The Breakfast Club.
It's not the Breakfast Club.
It's not
Supper
yeah,
Club.
Yeah, it's not cutesy, ironic 80s. No. One of the things I really like about The Hunger is, and I think, again, this ties into the broader Bowie-ness. Can we use that as a word? The Bowie-osity of Bowie.
Bowie-osity.
The vast Bowie-osity of David Bowie. Is this
how
issue
you spell
of,
that?
You can spell it however
Bowie-osity.
You want.
Bowie-osity. Okay, Bowie. I'm trying.
You can sing it to the Curiosity Show theme.
Yeah.
This idea of immortality. And we see that in the image, you know, this figure that literally won't die, this young pre-fame David Bowie that cannot be killed. Mm. He's indestructible. And time and time again, the painter in that film tries to kill him and he just keeps coming back.
Yeah.
It becomes a bit more, and that's a sort of dark, sensual film. And of course, in The Hunger, we have very similar things going on. And watching that film now, a lot older than I was when I first saw that movie, what really strikes me now, when I was younger, I think I was really taken just by Bowie's presence, you know, just the fact that it's a Bowie in a film. And of course, really swept away by the relationship between Susan Sarandon's character and Catherine Deneuve's characters. I mean, these are really...
And Catherine Deneuve doing a film like that, that's pretty
so
extraordinary.
Beautiful. I mean, these are giants of film. You know,
she doesn't do anything, does she? I mean, I call her the most... I call her still life, you know.
Absolutely.
She's the most still actress there is.
Absolutely. It's a very unusual film for her, and she's magnificent in it. Even without Bowie, this would be an incredible film.
Because she breaks down, which you don't see very often.
You really don't. The hair, you see a hair out of place. You know,
there's a strand of hair out of place. Something's wrong.
The idea of casting Bowie and Catherine
Deneuve
together.
Have you ever seen the... Sorry, beautiful. I'm digressing. Have you ever seen the post-film, the rap party? They had a famous rap party.
No.
Rap weekend, St. Moritz or something. Very
80s, of course.
The black and white photos, and it's really telling about the relationships between the three of them. They're having a good time.
That's great. Well, Sarandon and Bowie were having a relationship. They had a brief fling, I believe, during the making of that
film. Well, you can sense something going on there. And then there's Sarandon is just like with Bowie too. You can feel that too. I'm not saying they're with each other, but there's a real trio there. Interesting.
That's great. Oh, I have
dynamic.
To look for them. Beautiful.
Yes, just engine, you know, search engine. David Bowie, Catherine Deneuve, and, you know, after parties, and I think there's a pot plant scene or something, but and they're all black and white photos. It's hilarious, and it's like someone's taking these photos and they're not aware of it, but they're quite well photographed, so I'm wondering what's going on. You just don't know.
That's really interesting.
What's going
again,
on?
Again, it's that idea, like these photos of Bowie and, of course, the exhibition.
It feels like it's an act, like all three
this.
Of them.
Yep.
Like although Susan Sarandon does look a bit worse for wear. Like she's had a few, she's had a good time. But there's this thing between Bowie and Deneuve, like they're mirroring each other.
Is that
it's
interesting?
Weird. They've got the same hair colour at that stage, I think, too.
Wow.
Like that's when he went very platinum.
Very white.
Yes.
That was beautiful.
Just after that. So, yeah.
I find that the older that I get, what I'm really taken with is Bowie's fury. When there's a scene quite early on at the start where he realises that he's getting old very quickly. And that Miriam lied to him.
He's pissed.
She promised him immortality, and he read that as eternal youth. And when he realizes that that's not true, that he will live forever, but he's going to basically be like a rotting zombie, he goes to see Susan Sarandon, who's a geneticist, I think, gerontologist, who's studying the effects of rapid aging. And he's sitting in her waiting room. He spends a day sitting in her waiting room. And he ages, I think, from about 30 to 80. We see him age through makeup. And it's the fury. Like he doesn't say much, but just watching him go through that process now, like in 2015, Bowie's 68, and looking back at this career, you know, this figure who's always defined this kind of immortality. There's been something, like you said, there's something so uncanny and so ethereal and so unearthly about Bowie to watch him age in his across his career, like we're seeing at this exhibition, and to see that kind of reflected in such a different way in The Hunger. I just think that's magical. It's a really interesting parallel.
It's like, interesting. It's,
because it is this same kind of immortality. You know, Bowie himself as a figure, you know, it is these issues of immortality and eternal youth. Mm. You know, when I think of Bowie, when I picture Bowie, the first image that comes up in my head is 70s. He's like Ziggy.
Yeah, is
Ziggy
that the first
era
one?
Bowie. And he is kind of immortal. He is kind of ageless.
It's hard to pick. I mean, for me, I might get Ziggy, but then I'm suddenly... My favourite era is the Berlin, so-called Berlin era with the trilogy there.
You seen Christiane F?
Yeah.
That was a big one for me growing up.
That was amazing. Yep. That was amazing.
Very formative.
Saw that on a VHS that someone had acquired from somewhere and played it on the, you know, at some other person's house, because there's no way I could watch that in front of my folks, in front of my parents, no way. And we just kept watching it. We would just keep rewinding it and going... It's incredible. And, of course, he did a German language version of the
soundtrack, which is beautiful,
which I had and I've lost. But
it's gorgeous.
But amazing. And it
Christiane has an amazing Bowie jacket. I don't know if you remember
that.
Oh,
it's the red jacket, is it?
Yeah, with Bowie, really kind of clunky letters, just Bowie on the back of a kind of, what do they call, like a college letterman jacket?
Very
interesting. I always wanted that jacket.
Yeah. It reminds me of the Scorpio Rising jacket, a little bit of Kenneth Anger there. And you just think, my goodness, you know. You watch that film and I know it's a pretty harsh film. It's not
it's brutal.
For.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's brutal, isn't it?
It is really
so
vicious.
Raw and vicious. Yep. What was it, 1981, 82 or something? Hard to believe that it got away with. They got away with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pretty much a real life sort of story. But it's a real horror. It's a real horror story, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It really formative, I think, for a certain generation of us that really grew up with that film. That and the book Go Ask Alice, I think they were almost like bookends for me.
Exactly.
Sort of warning tales about drugs and sex. You know, be a nice girl.
But you can't look away. You can't watch it again and again.
She's hanging out with Bowie, so how bad can it be?
I know. The nightclub scene, isn't that a great scene? I think it's one of the earlier scenes. And it's one camera shot, perhaps, a little bit. Feels like it's a one camera shot. And she goes into the club. And it's just that sense of voyeurism and like they're doing something really bad and naughty. And, you know, it's exciting. And the soundtrack's just thumping.
Absolutely.
With his signature music.
With his presence.
Just thumping.
And I think that's one of the things that really intrigues me about Bowie in film as an actor. Across the board, like right up to, you know, more recent stuff like Christopher Nolan's The Prestige, things like this.
Yeah.
Bowie's presence in film, like he has a star presence that almost harkens back to classical Hollywood. You know, when Bowie's on the screen, there's an energy that just radiates off the screen. It's just
when Bowie's playing Bowie, though. I mean,
even when he's not, and this is one of the things that I find really interesting. And so, in The Prestige, he plays Nikola Tesla. One of the things I'm really interested in is when he plays figures from history. So he played Nikola Tesla in The Prestige. He played Andy Warhol in Basquiat. And of course, he played Pontius Pilate in The Last Temptation of Christ by Martin Scorsese.
Apparently, his sandals are going to be at the David Bowie.
No way, not the toga. I can
if you bring your own toga.
I'd love to see the toga. I can do with the sandals, Pontius Pilate's sandals. Those roles, I think, are really important because they're all quite famous historical figures. But what they do, the casting of Bowie in those roles, we appreciate the importance of these historical figures because they're played by Bowie. It's never a case that he doesn't play these roles and he's not, I don't think he's directed to play these roles, expecting us to forget that he's David Bowie, to be so taken by what a great actor he is. That we forget that they're David Bowie. I don't think it works that way at all. I think it's the other way around, that the very presence of Bowie adds weight and adds gravity to the importance of
these
figures.
I hope he never
has
to play Tony Abbott then. That would be a disaster.
He doesn't. Oh, that's not a role
significant.
That's not a role that I think would demand much weight or gravity.
We could get budgie smugglers, but
we could just get a mop.
That's a horrible thought, isn't it?
Digressed.
Sorry, digresses. Degenerated. basically, no. Yes, I mean I love Basquiat, and of course
he's a wonderful Warhol.
Oh, isn't he
wonderful?
Like he's
funny.
The Warhol we would like to think was Warhol.
Absolutely.
I'm not saying Warhol was bad, but Warhol was Warhol.
I think that
and
it's played in a very knowing way. I think that Bowie plays it with a knowledge that people will know that he is Bowie.
And remember that.
And
I love
think
that
it's
scene.
So clever the way that he's directed.
I love
Julia Schnabel's a great director. Yeah. He's a really good director. Yeah. He knew exactly.
What's he done lately?
He did The Diving Bell yeah. and The Butterfly in 2007, yeah. and he did Before Night Falls in 2000.
That was brilliant.
I'm not sure what he's done since The Diving Bell and
maybe
The Butterfly.
Maybe he's gone back to painting. Yeah, oh, well, could. You know.
Maybe.
Smashing Plates or something.
I think he did a documentary. We did another film about Basquiat as well, but I'm not sure what that was.
But, yeah, with the Basquiat, I love the scene where they're walking just through the rundown part of New York as it was at that stage, and they're just talking about the future, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful dialogue, whether it happened or not, doesn't matter.
Bowie brings his own history, I think, and I like that, you know, that he kind of, you know, his presence makes its own history, that gravity and that weightiness of Bowie's presence, whether it's in film, whether it's in music, whether it's just as a kind of pop cultural icon, wherever he is, things become important because of his presence. And he's not a dick about that. And we know that from films like Zoolander. You know, one of my favorite cameos of all time is David Bowie in Zoolander, where he gets it. You know, I mean, he's just, I can't imagine anybody else in that role. He's only in the film for such a brief moment, but he's making fun of the Bowie-ness of Bowie. You know, that this is what I do. I kind of, you know, I'm here at this kind of showdown between this epic walk-off between these two insanely stupid male models.
Yeah, yeah.
As David Bowie. I think it's really funny.
It's hilarious.
There's never a self-importance to Bowie's presence. It's sort of beyond that. There is a real humor to it at times.
I think it's the interesting thing too. I mean, what he brought to when he was at the Hansa Studios and the myths surrounding that now, you know, with East and West. And for him to be there at that time, you know, there are some mysteries, you know, about what really brought down the wall. And in my mind, it had something to do with...
It was Bowie.
Bowie. He looked at one of those guards in a certain way. One of those red guards, and that
this,
was it.
We don't need this stinking wall.
No, no. I could just imagine the two red guards kissing and saying, "We love Bowie," and walking off.
Bauhaus playing in the background.
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't that be excellent?
We're having our own little kind of slash fic moment here.
I think it's turning into something like that. So for you, I mean, look, the symposium and everything, such a big weekend.
It is.
I know.
It's all Bowie, all day. Just the way it should
it
be.
It starts at 8:30 a.m.
It does.
It's incredible.
No, it would be fantastic. There's a really diverse range of speakers, which is fantastic. Some really great topics. People have things to say about Bowie, and people
have things to say, and they're coming all this way.
They're traveling from all around the world, which is wonderful to kind of come together. You're and have a little Bowie.
Do
Bowie
you know
party.
Who you're on with? You're
actually
with
don't.
Dennis Flannery, according to this.
Yep.
Ian Chapman and Tim Highfield.
Ah, oh, token girl. Good.
So good. You've got, you know, the sisterhood is you.
I bring the boobs. I bring the boobs.
I actually got an email from Dennis. I got in touch with him. He sounds lovely, by
the
way. He goes, "Oh, I'm excited." He's very excited.
That's
and
great.
Jet-lagged,
well,
he'll say.
I don't remember the names, but I do remember their topics. And I thought that it looks like a really, the panel looks like a really
it's
diverse.
Amazing.
I mean, these are, a lot of these people are really high quality researchers, you know, and historians. So what they're bringing to the table are some really fascinating, not just perspectives on Bowie, but perspectives that are backed up by some really interesting research.
And also some one of the most fascinating films, I think, that came out in the last 15 years or so, A Velvet Goldmine, Todd Haynes.
That's a masterpiece.
It's interesting.
The Bowie biopic you have when you're not having a Bowie biopic.
Exactly.
And when you decide to make Citizen Kane as well. Like, I mean, it's genius. It's genius. Mm, like a Bowie biopic with a...
Without any Bowie music.
With a Roxy basically. Music soundtrack. Some by Tom York. Do it. Just go for it. Like, Todd Haynes, he's a force to be reckoned with. If you describe that to somebody without having seen Velvet Goldmine, they would probably think you were making it up, like just throwing random names together.
Christian Bale before American Psycho.
Yeah. Ewan McGregor is Iggy Pop. Who is perfect?
Yes.
Eddie Izzard, dollar sign eyes.
Top and bottoming on top of a house in Manhattan, apartment in Manhattan. No, it won't happen, but it did.
It's beautiful.
It's amazing.
It's an incredible movie.
With fur coats and fur collared denim jackets, and it's hilarious.
And lots of platforms.
Will Dogs in Space be playing? Do you know?
Not that I know. That's an interesting question.
Because that's an
interesting
film.
I didn't even think of that before, but there's a lovely Bowie connection.
I wish I'd been there. I mean, I can't imagine people queuing for 3 weeks. Is that for real?
Apparently. I mean,
MCG.
It sounds, you know, but I don't think people did that for the Glass Spider tour. from memory.
Oh, ouch.
I know. Ow.
Although the last time
he toured here, I think we were all online. I know I got my tickets online. It's not quite the same, is it?
When did he last tour?
No, it would have been 2004, 2005. I remember being online to get my tickets, and it was just, you know, but not the same as lining up with Michael Hutchence.
Yes.
No. For 3 weeks, you know, three with a sleeping weeks. Bag.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Like, incredible.
People do beautiful. That. No, not anymore. But maybe if he ever, do you think he'd ever go on tour again? I believe that it would be an insurance policy from hell, because insurers just won't touch it.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess the question is, does he need to, you know, where is he at this point?
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's obviously his business to just, you know, to make that call. But my feeling is that he's earned his stripes. I can say that though, because I saw him. Like, that was when I saw him in the early 2000s, it's like, I will never see him. This is my chance.
Mm.
And after I saw him, I remembered thinking, I don't need to see anybody else. This is the last, this is my bucket list.
I didn't get
until
to see
Kate
him.
Bush announced her tour, which but is a different
thing. I got close to him in a strange sort of way, a couple of strange ways. The Sirius Moonlight tour in the 80s was the big one for him. I think it was his big, huge stadium. Sirius Moonlight tour was pretty massive, and I was too young to go and see it, but I moved into a share house or a flat, as they call in New Zealand many years later, and there was this really strange sort of structure out in the backyard. I was thinking, what is this? And they'd say, look, watch, just stand on the middle there. And they went out the back, there's a little garden shed, and there's wires coming out, and they pressed a button, and it would elevate up and down a few feet and then stop, and they go, oh, it's a bit rusty because it's been in the rain for years. And I was like, well, what the hell is it? It's from the Sirius Moonlight tour. David That's Bowie amazing. Stood on that. And they were part of the construction crew, and they acquired it. They appropriated.
That could have been in the Acme exhibition. Just you coming up and down on this rusty
hold. It didn't go up very high. But I was just standing there and thinking, I didn't dawn on to this me later. It. I'm standing where Bowie stood.
That's
in
amazing.
The backyard of a Greylin flat, you know.
That's beautiful.
In Auckland, New Zealand. It's weird. And then again, years later, a friend of mine who was she still is very gorgeous. She was a model for a while. She was very, very beautiful. And she got, you know, to meet Bowie himself. So, because he did like the ladies. It was the 80s, I think. So he did like beautiful ladies. He still does. You know, I mean, let's face it.
Absolutely.
A man and everything.
And beautiful ladies like him. Beautiful men like him.
Everybody
beautiful
does.
Beautiful people like Bowie.
That throw can be, themselves.
That can be the slogan, beautiful people like Bowie.
I can't wait. Are you going to do any of the fan things? There's some fan...
I'm not sure yet. I'm going to get the symposium out of the way, and then I'm going to have a little breather. And
we've got till November, because it is going till November the 1st. Mm.
So it should be great. Well, when I saw him in the early 2000s, he's a very good performer. He's very good at his job, and I was maybe second or third row, and he definitely... Wow. He gave eye contact to everybody that was within eye contact reach. So he absolutely looked at me and my friend during China Girl.
Wow. And we were like, that's my other Bowie connection.
We can die now. We can die. See, Bowie looked at us and we can die.
I'm showing off now. But
bring it. You did the Bowie up and down thing.
I worked with Ji Ling years later.
Oh, really?
Well, she was a door bitch, basically. An awesome door bitch, I have to say. Or receptionist at a nightclub.
That's a big claim to fame. That's a big Bowie
and
claim to
fame. Yeah, she said my name a few times. Sonia, could you get me a lemonade with lime or a slice of lemon? Yeah, so I felt pretty.
That's, yeah.
That was Ji Ling. Like, everybody went, you're China girl. And she's like, yes. She got a bit annoyed after a while.
I bet she did. I often wondered whether that wore a bit thin for her.
Thin white Duke and all that. But wasn't it an amazing videos? Now, the videos from the 80s, huge. Look at them.
I was going to say blue jean. Like, talking about the cinematic. I mean, that was, I think, the first.
Didn't we wait for weeks for that to come out? People used to wait for.
I mean, Thriller. Thriller was like that big event, film music video, that the long form of Thriller. But I think for me, Blue Jean was really the next big one after that. That next event music video.
I think they advertised it. They advertised it. It's coming, and we'd be like, okay.
It was quite,
and it was like,
that was a really big deal when that came out. And it is a short film.
Yeah.
As much as Thriller is a really
I don't think it's that great,
film.
But it's just
you know,
the
I
hype.
Remembered, I remembered at the time thinking this is just kind of hype, but over the years I've grown quite fond of it. It's going great. Back to Blue Jean, and maybe it's just because I like the song a bit more. I was always a, I always call that a, in a reference to Velvet Goldmine. I always think of that era of Bowie as the Tommy Steele Bowie, you know, that kind of phase.
Yeah. If he did Vegas, what would you say if Bowie ever did Vegas?
Oh, Vegas is my spiritual homeland. I got married in Vegas. I love Vegas. Okay. So that would be all the food groups covered for me.
Right. Yeah. Imagine if he did Vegas. That would be,
I don't know whether he'd ever need to. Again, it's that thing like, I think the impression that I get is that he's actually kind of just, he's done the things that he's wanted to do, and he's got room now to not do things in the public space if he doesn't want to.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that he isn't involved with the exhibition. David Bowie is he's handed over his archives and all his collection, which is extraordinary to have faith and trust people that he can do that. And that just means it feels like he's relaxed.
Yeah.
He's not trying to do anything. And look, I think he's trying to prove anything.
He's always been quite savvy about knowing the difference between Bowie the icon and Bowie the person. I read an interview recently with Dave Gahan from Depeche Mode, who was saying that his daughter went to school with Bowie's daughter. They were at the same primary school, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only time that he met David Bowie, was when they were both there to pick up their kids from school. and Dave Gahan was very starstruck.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh my gosh, it's David Bowie. These two British guys at an expensive, you know, primary school in the middle of New York.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, it's David Bowie. But he said it was just the conversation that they had was just two guys picking their kids up from school. That there was nothing about their interaction that was, oh, you're an internationally famous superstar. I'm an internationally famous superstar. Hi, how's that going for you? He said it was just two dudes picking up their kids from school, having a chat, you know, about sports days and things like that. Just this really normal.
Maybe
that both of those guys, you know, they both have these amazing stories and they've kind of earned the right to have some normal time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I feel
it's
about
nice
Bowie.
To like, know that. It feels relaxed. It feels like, not that he's retired.
No.
I can't imagine he would not be doing things somewhere.
I get the feeling that he's not in the limelight for the sake of it.
Yeah.
You know, he's not craving that kind of attention out of habit. I think that, you know, if he wanted to do something like Kate Bush, you know, Kate Bush is probably another really good point of comparison in that she did something when she was ready to do something, but it wasn't because she needed to, it was because she wanted to. And that's how I feel about Bowie.
Wow, it's going to be an amazing exhibition. So much to talk about and so many different and interesting people that will be putting it under the microscope. And I think we're all learning. I mean, I'm relearning things about Bowie.
Oh, absolutely.
And reminding myself of things and revisiting things and finding out new things. And that's just amazing.
Watch The Image.
That's my
advice to you. If you want to find out some new things about Bowie, watch pre-fame Bowie, 1967. It's often dated 1969 because that's the year it was released. It was made in 1967.
Yeah, so what, he was 20?
Yeah.
20 years old?
£30 he earned. It's beautiful.
That's amazing. Yay. Well, what are you looking forward to in the symposium weekend, apart from doing your own panel?
Getting mine out of the way. so I'm kind of glad that I'm on quite early. And then really just kicking back and soaking up other people's perspectives. My perspective is very specific in that I'm focused on Bowie and film and Bowie and horror. So a very, very specific avenue. And so I've been very much concentrating on that in particular. So I'm really looking forward to expanding my range to other people.
Interesting.
Start rethinking some things about Bowie that perhaps I take for granted.
Yeah, well, there's going to be covers and collaborations. That looks good. Just about, how Bowie affects other communities and fans and what they do and how he inspires and people do covers and all of that.
There's a lot of time to cover too. Like in terms of a historical period. Yeah, I mean, I start in 67. That's a lot of work.
We start with the Laughing Gnome because that's
I do. I will name drop the Laughing Gnome just for you.
Thank you. That'd be great.
Hold up a little Joy logo when I mention the Laughing Gnome.
That is a strange little song.
You can play it.
I might play it. I have to play it. I have to play it with this podcast and interview.
it is.
Cool.
Let it be.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking to us here on Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. Alexandra Helen Nicholas.
Thanks for having me.
And where can you be found? Where can people find out more about you and what you do?
I'm on Twitter. I'm a very active Twitter person. Mm-hmm. So I'm at Suspiria Alex, SuspiriaLex. That's where I am most of the time talking about film. I'm also on Triple R. Can I mention?
Yeah, of course.
I'm on Plato's Cave on Triple R. I'm a film critic every Monday night from 7 to 8 o'clock
Cool.
on Triple R with my Plato's Cave film criticism team.
Your crew mm-hmm. includes Thomas Caldwell.
Thomas Caldwell, Cerise Howard,
yep.
and Josh Nelson. They're my little film posse.
And people might remember Thomas used to do the casting couch with Mark Pace back in the day here on Joy. So I think the podcasts of that are still in existence.
Oh, wow.
You may be
another historical relic.
I know. You may be able to look that out. Check that out on the archives on joy.org.au. Just put in, I think it's what they call them, resting shows.
Hey.
And just
that's a nice way to put it.
Resting, retired. Resting shows, just put in the casting couch. So it used to be 2 hours.
Wow.
You're just an hour?
We're just an hour.
That's still
2 hours is a lot of air.
2 hours is a lot, isn't it?
Thomas is an interesting guy. He's got things to say.
Sure is. All right. Thank you very much for speaking to us here on Sci-Fi and Scream. Enjoy 94.9.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the special podcast about David Bowie.
It included many of the folks who were at ACMI and the David Bowie Is forums and exhibitions held only in Melbourne until November 1st, 2015. We hope you enjoyed this. We'll have more podcasts to come.
Thank you for listening to the special David Bowie presentation by Joy 94.9.
Interviews helmed by Sonia Hammer from Sci-Fi and Scream and Queer Geeks of Oz and Geek Girls Speak and Emily Dwyer and Patrick Whelan-Smith from Joy 94.9 and Lauren Stardust herself. Interviews by Lauren Stardust and Sonia Hammer for Joy 94.9. Enjoy this podcast.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.